Well, welcome everyone here tonight. There seems to be a very good spirit in the room, and I think that follows some good weather. And we're having another class tonight by our brother David Herman. And I think you agree that the previous classes have been very thoughtful and considered with good interaction, and I'm sure that tonight will follow in that fashion. We're considering the forgiveness of Joseph, but as an introduction, we'll have a reading. I think I failed to neglect those that might be listening in online and with us in that fashion as well. And for any visitors that you might have with us here tonight, you're more than welcome, and it's great to see you. Now, we're going to listen shortly to our brother David talking around the subject, the forgiveness of Joseph. And he's asked that as an introduction, we read from the last part of Genesis, Genesis chapter 50, verses 15 to 26. So that's an introduction for you, brother David. We call you forward now. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you all for coming along tonight. And thank you very much for the opportunity to have done this series with you. I've really appreciated it and found it valuable for myself, and I hope it's been a little worthwhile for you as well. It's forced me to think about a few things and take a fresh look at the life of Joseph, which for many of us is pretty familiar, but there's a lot of detail in there, and so it's quite worth looking at some of the things that we don't automatically pick up on. I'm going to go back to one quick point from the very first session. The mere fact that so much of the book of Genesis is actually all about Joseph says a great deal about the importance that God places on his life and the example that he gives to us. There's more written about him than anybody else in Genesis, including Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So that alone tells us that he's a very significant person in God's eyes. Now, tonight's title is The Forgiveness of Joseph, but I'm not going to get straight into that because that's the sort of thing I want us to almost finish with tonight. So I want us to actually think a little bit about Joseph's interactions with his brothers. So you might want to follow along with this. I'm not going to read it all. I probably will summarise the things that are said there, but I'm going to get you to think about what's going on. So maybe let's start in Genesis 42, which is all about the time that the brothers first come to Egypt. And as you probably all know, Joseph wasn't all that nice to them. So Joseph treated them harshly. That's in verses 7 to 12 of Genesis 42. He accused them of being spies. And, they promised that they were honest men, that they weren't spies, and so he gave them a test, that one of them was to return home and bring their youngest brother back to prove that they were telling the truth. And the next thing he does is put them in prison for 3 days. And now's your first time to get some input into this. Why did he do that? Who's with the roaming mic this week? Sam. Thanks. We should be able to come up with a few answers. Why did he lock them up in prison?
Thank you. Maybe he wanted to give them a taste of what he'd experienced while he was in prison in Egypt.
Okay. He
didn't want them to escape before he had a chance to actually talk to them.
Okay.
Give them some time to sit and think about things for a little bit.
Okay. Okay. We got some more?
He might have wanted to hear what they were saying amongst themselves, get an insight into where they're at.
Possibly, although if they're in prison, he mightn't have heard too much.
Was that maybe how long Joseph was in the pit? Does it say how long he was in the pit?
No, it doesn't, but it doesn't give the impression that it was that long.
Yeah.
So I don't think it was that. But I concur with quite a few of those things, especially that I believe he wanted them to think. I believe that Joseph himself learned a great deal, and I'll probably talk about that a little bit more later. But yeah, when you're in prison, there's not much else to do. So you are forced to sit and think about things, and I think that was a very important part of what Joseph was ultimately trying to do. I don't think he was wanting to make them feel terrible. I think he just wanted them to think about their lives and to start thinking about what was happening and why it might be happening, and hopefully give them a nudge in the right direction. Anyway, after that, he softened his attitude and chose just for Simeon to be retained in Egypt, and then the rest were to go home and bring their youngest brother back, which is in verses 18 to 20. And he had Simeon bound in front of them, so they could see that he was serious, and Simeon, unfortunately, was going to stay in prison all the time they were away, which would have been quite a considerable time. Ultimately, what is Joseph doing in all of this? He didn't have to do any of this. What's he got in mind? What's his long-term goal in some of these things? And there's more things that are a bit surprising. So, roaming mic out again. Sorry, Sam. Up the back. Why is Joseph treating them like this?
Sorry, I've just had my brain into gear and answering your question, but also saying why I locked them up. They're all grown men with their own lives. They've probably not spent much time in each other's company now. And so he's sort of trying to see if they're actually all cohesive and working together and all got the same aims, or if they're all self-centered and self-seeking. So that's probably one of the other reasons why, to answer your question now, but also why he probably cooped them up together, because they've been so independent for so long. What are they like now working together?
Hadn't thought of that first point, but so the second point, I can see exactly what you're saying.
I said it.
Sorry. What's interesting, I think, is that in verse 23, they did not know that Joseph understood them, for he spoke to them through an interpreter. And it tells us in the three verses before, that what their conversation was that he was listening to without them being aware that he understood. And I think it's interesting that almost immediately, verse 21, we are truly guilty concerning our brother. They hit the nail on the head, absolutely, first thing. And it goes on in verse 22, Reuben sort of says, well, I told you so, you know, kind of, I said you shouldn't have done it. And it continues down to verse 28, where it says, their hearts failed them, and they were afraid, saying one to another, what is this that God has done to us? And I can almost imagine Joseph saying, yes, finally, you've got it.
Sorry, did you have a copy of my notes, by the way?
David, I think we've just read chapter 50, and he was trying to get them to come to that point that they realised that God was in all of this and he was directing these affairs to this end, which Joseph knew all along and recognised, but I think that's what he was trying to do by this process.
Just one word, reconciliation, which I think in French means to meet again. And I think he's trying to reconcile the brothers with themselves and with Joseph, and they're also literally meeting again.
Okay.
Yeah, just agreeing very much with what Ted and Graham said. I think the key really is given to us here in Genesis 50 when they're looking back on these events, and Joseph says, well, the whole point of all of this was to save you. And so, you know, and that's not just physically saving them from the famine, but as you've mentioned in the previous classes, like it was to save them out of the idolatry of the Canaanites, and Joseph's doing his part there to see, well, how's their characters developing? How's their reconciliation relationships, as Graham was saying, not just with each other, but also with God, right? How's their relationship with God going? And, you know, do they understand these things? How's their character been developing? And we've really got to, you know, that's what we're told in Genesis 50. It's all about, it's about saving them. And so really we've got to view everything that Joseph does through that lens since we've been given that insight.
Excellent. We're coming up with lots of good answers. And, oh, there's more.
I've got a note in against verse 28, how that when the brothers say, what is this that God hath done unto us, that this is the first occurrence of God being mentioned in their lives. Mm. And then in verse 18, Joseph says to them, this do and live, for I fear God. Now, he is Egyptian, saying to the brothers who are not Egyptian, I fear this God. So it's almost like it's put God into their minds and they've had 3 days to get to them reflecting and getting to God.
So Joseph is really eager to see genuine character growth in them, genuine growth in faith, them bringing God into their lives and considering him important in what's going on. And this pressure is forcing them to think about what they have done and, you know, to change. And to put it simply, I think Joseph's long-term goal with all of these things that he's doing to them is to truly recognise whether they have repented. Have they changed? Have they just got older, or have they grown spiritually? And I totally agree with Stephen that we get a very clear indication of that, because he's listening to them for the first time he's heard, thinking about what they've done to their brother, right? That would have meant a lot to him to know that they now are starting to regret that, and they remember the anguish that they caused him. Now, I've got to move on a bit more quickly because there have been more answers than I expected, but that's all good. So, one more thing from that chapter. Joseph organises to put the money in their sacks. You all know about that. And I was going to ask, why does he do that? But there's a lot of possible answers to that. I'm just going to give you a few. I think he want them to be a little confused, so they had to stop and think and maybe even ask God about this. Maybe it was also a sign of grace that he was being generous to them, even though he was giving them a hard time. And I suspect he once again was wanting them to think about what God was doing in all of this. So let's go straight on to chapter 43 for those who are trying to follow it. So they all go back. Jacob hears the terrible news and is really, really unhappy about sending Benjamin along. And that occupies a lot of time, and I'm not going to go into that. And it takes them a great deal of desperation almost to get him to agree to allow Benjamin to go back to Egypt with them. And I think it's quite fascinating that Jacob actually gets the brothers to take double the money for the seed this time, as well as the original amount that they'd had put back in their sacks. And he says, right, I also want you to take honey, spice, myrrh, pistachios and almonds. And I could easily ask you what you think of that, but I think he's trying to buy favour with the Egyptian, who's Joseph. He's going a bit back to, I think, his old tricks of trying to manipulate people, which Jacob certainly was experienced at earlier on in his life. Anyway, this time, when they come along, after the initial exchange and Benjamin's there, so that's the evidence that they were being honest men, he invites them to dine with him. Now, that would have been absolutely unforeseen. Why would you invite these foreigners to eat with you? And I'm sure, well, we know from what we read that they were shocked, absolutely shocked about this. And in fact, they were worried. They thought this was because Joseph was going to actually challenge them about the money in their sacks and just take charge of them and send them all off to prison. One of the interesting things, which alludes to a similar verse that someone else has mentioned, they asked the steward of Joseph's house about the money in their sacks. In other words, does he know where that's come from? And did they get the money that they were supposed to have received? And the steward of Joseph's house says, yes, we had the money. And his explanation is that their God must have provided it. Now, I will throw in a question here. What do you think that tells us about Joseph? We've had a little hint of it already. This steward, this Egyptian, says their God has provided that money. What does that tell us about Joseph?
He spoke about God to
the people
around.
He is teaching them about God. You know, he's taking the opportunity because he's in authority over them. He's going to let them know what he believes and what's made a difference in his life. He is teaching them. Sorry, we should have waited for the mic, shouldn't we? That's all right. I think I repeated what was said. So, even far away in Egypt, he's still bringing people to God. Obviously, there's a message for us in that. So, Joseph immediately asks about their father and meets Benjamin. And he is so emotional about that he has to rush off into another room and cry on his own away from the other people. And we get quite a few hints throughout the story that he's quite an emotional man. He's been through a lot and his emotions are easily moved. Anyway, he wined and dined them and he gave Benjamin 5 times all of the food and everything else that the others had. But there's one thing that must, I think, have really puzzled them. Anyone got any clues as to what I'm talking about? Sebastian's going to have a go, but he's not the only one that...
Yeah, you talk about
when he
seated them in order. It says that it's the firstborn according to his birthright and the youngest according to his youth. So that means, if I'm reading that correctly, that means it's not actually age order, which could maybe, if you're really good at it, be guessed, but actually he put Judah before Simeon and Levi and Reuben if it's according to birthright. Because Simeon, Levi, and Reuben had forfeited their position as firstborn in the family, like Jacob, and Jacob had given that now to Judah. So if I'm reading that correctly, that's firstborn according to birthright. It's like, how could he possibly know that?
I reckon this would have really just messed with their head all night. He was there for all that time with them, and you know the chances of doing that with so many sons, 11 sons in order, is huge, hugely small. It's a very small chance of just guessing at that. And even if you see some differences in age, that would have been very difficult. So just imagine what they're feeling in this. You know, wow. This would have been a very confusing time. They've gone from feeling threatened about even being there and all of a sudden he just seems to know all about them. This was a surprising time. Let's move on to Genesis 44. Because I don't want to run myself short of time to talk about forgiveness. So Joseph organised for the brothers to be given as much seed as they could carry. They were going to be sent back again. But this time, once again, he put the money back in their sacks and Joseph's silver cup is in Benjamin's sack. What's he doing now? He's got some hint about things from before, but what's he doing now?
Seeing how honest they are.
Can't say anything without the microphone.
Seeing how honest they are.
Okay, but they've already been honest enough to have brought back the money, so I'm not sure that's the main thing. Now, there's a few other suggestions.
Just a very quick one. I'm not sure. Yeah, here we go. Just a quick one on that one. I think he's now pointing them towards having set the family order there. He's now singling out this particular family area. And I think he's guiding them that way with this silver cup.
So I'm not sure I know what you mean.
Well, Benjamin is basically Joseph's brother.
Right.
So I think he's actually now drawing the attention of the other brothers to this particular brother.
Okay.
So previously they hated Dad's favourite. Obviously now Benjamin is the new Dad's favourite. How do they feel about him? Are they going to hand him over to get drawn and quartered and don't care? Or are they actually going to care this time? So,
Yep. That's where I'm going. Yeah. He really wants to know whether they are changed enough to now start caring about Benjamin, his brother. And that, that's jumping ahead a little. You just know the story too well. Right, so the brothers left home the next morning. They were soon overtaken by Joseph's steward, who accused them of doing evil by taking his master's cup that he used for divination as well as for drinking. Of course, they were shocked because they knew they hadn't done anything wrong. And they said if anyone's found with a cup, then they'll all be put to death. That son would be put to death and they'd all become the master's slaves. Obviously, the cup was found in Benjamin's sack and they just tore their robes in grief. They knew they were in a really bad situation this time. So they were taken back to Joseph, who asked them what they had done. And Judah leads the response. He said that they do not know how they could explain it or clear their name. He knew that he was in a real corner. In fact, all of them were. And he actually starts talking about God. He said that God was exposing their guilt and said that they would all be his slaves. Joseph didn't like that idea. He said, no, that wouldn't be fair. He would only take the guilty party, and so we would only take Benjamin as his slave. And you probably know what's coming up next, but let's go straight on. Judah goes up to him and talks to him quietly. He explains how much his father loved Benjamin and that his father would die if Benjamin did not return. He pleaded with Joseph to accept him as a replacement for his brother Benjamin. And that's what led to him revealing himself to his brothers. Why is it that moment that he's finished with the charade and is prepared to reveal himself? The biggest test. They've passed the test. Not only do they care for their brother Benjamin enough to sacrifice themselves, or specifically Judah, they also care about what it's going to do to their father. Because we need to realise that what they did to Joseph also they did in a sense to his father. They deprived him of his son. And so it appears that they really now have been changed. They really do care. Other people's well-being matters to them enough for Judah to actually offer his life as a slave for the rest of them to go. And this obviously brought him overwhelming joy. It was exactly what he wanted to hear. And so he just couldn't hold himself back, right? He actually started in their presence just crying. And it was so loud that the servants in the house all heard, and apparently it was so loud that presumably the nearby servants of Pharaoh heard it. So his emotions had been bottled up for so long, he was just overwhelmed with this and so eager now to actually reveal himself to them. But this question, I think, is a little more interesting. How come Judah's so different? So I won't say what did he do. In the first place, you all know what he did. Judah, in the beginning, was after quick money rather than the guilt that would have come on him and his family if they'd all put Joseph to death. He just thought, no, let's make some money out of this. No feeling at all for Joseph, no feeling for Jacob, But now he's the opposite. You know, they could all go home scot-free, but no, he's prepared to offer his life as a slave to actually prevent that from happening. What led to this massive change? Sam, you need it up the back.
I mean, it's probably a combination of many things that really led to a full change in his character, but one thing that really stands out to me is Judah at this point now understands what it's like to lose a son, whereas when he did that to Joseph, he was young, he didn't have his own family, it seems, at that point. But in the chapters in between, like in chapter 38, in between selling Joseph into Egypt and now... he's coming with Benjamin. He's had his own family. Some of his own sons have died. He really understands how hard that would be for his father, because he's had some, you know, he knows how it feels for him as a father towards his own sons.
And he's also had his hypocrisy exposed with the incident of Tamar. So he had that moment where he's got to make a choice. Is he going to own up to who he is truly? Or is he going to continue with the facade? And he's chosen to own up truly. And so when they say we are true men, in his case, that's genuine. This is genuine Judah. It is who he is.
Okay. Now, yes, the first two sons were killed by God, basically, Judah's two sons, because they were so wicked. Right? And let's... I'm not going to take you there. I'm just going to talk about it, because we've had some wonderful answers there, which I want to take a little bit further. I think what Ben has said is the crucial thing. Do you all know the story of chapter 38? I don't want to spend too much time on it. But anyways, I'm going to very quickly tell it to you. Okay, the second son was married to Tamar. Right, and Tamar, the first son was married to Tamar. The second son was supposed to then have the Levirate marriage, and become the new husband to raise up seed for the first brother. And he refused to do that, so God put him to death. And Judah refused to do anything about it for, you know, what appears to be a very, very long time. And so she's left as a widow with no future, and she takes things into her own hands and basically pretends to be a prostitute, a shrine prostitute. Judah takes advantage of that. She kept proof of who it was, and then it came out later after she was pregnant. Judah actually said she ought to be put to death. He was really angry, full of righteous indignation that wasn't justified. And so basically when Tamar showed what she had received from him and proved that he was the one who did it, simply he was utterly humiliated. What is the most effective way to be humbled? To be humiliated publicly. When you know that everybody knows that you're a fake, you've pretended to be good and righteous and you're not, it's very hard to feel the same again. He was forced and confessed publicly that Tamar was more righteous than him, even though he'd threatened to have her put to death. And I actually think that this is the reason for that chapter, which seems so out of place in the story. That's why it's there, because it actually gives us a crucial piece of evidence of what's going on in Judah's life and in Judah's heart. So the more public the humiliation, the more effective the humbling. And as we know, or should know, humility is one of the most vital qualities that we must have in coming to God. Right. Blessed are the poor in spirit. It's really painful to be humiliated, but it makes a lasting difference. So, Joseph finally reveals himself to his brothers. He says to them, "Come near to me, please." And they did. He said, "I'm your brother Joseph, who you sold into Egypt." This is Genesis 45, verse 4 onwards. "Now don't be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither ploughing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and ruler over all the land of Egypt. Hurry and go up to my father and say to him, 'Thus says your son, Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me, do not tarry. You shall dwell in the land of Goshen and you shall be near me, you and your children and your children's children and your flocks, your herds and all that you have. And there I will provide for you. For there are yet 5 years of famine to come in you, so that you and your household and all that you have do not come to poverty. And now your eyes see, and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see, that it is I, my mouth, that speaks to you. You must tell my father of all my honour in Egypt and of all that you have seen. Hurry and bring my father down here.' Then he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept upon his neck, and he kissed all his brothers and wept upon them. And after that, the brothers talked with him." It took them quite a bit of convincing to believe that, in fact, that was Joseph, that it was really him. But he made very clear that he had forgiven them. He made it clear that they don't have to be distressed about what they did to him in the past, even though they mistreated him. He makes it clear that God was the one who sent him to Egypt, and he used that to save many lives. He made it clear that he would provide for the family and that he wanted to renew his relationship with his family and that this was a time of overwhelming joy for him. Basically, I think Joseph was showing that if God was with him, then he could endure anything, including the years of hardship as a slave, the years of jail, and they went on for a very long time. Basically, I believe that he was about 17 when he was put into the pit, and it's about 30 before he actually got to this position in Pharaoh's household. So 13 years, and then there's a couple of extra years due to another 7-odd years at least, because of the good times having gone and the hard times having come. So this is a long, long time that he's been away from his family. Joseph spent a lot of his time thinking and praying, and he has turned all of this negative into a positive. His response, I think, is crystallized by two key words. He says, "But God." As soon as you bring God into the picture, the whole perspective changes. It turned a negative into a positive. He spent so much of that time, I believe, thinking and praying. God was with him. Why would God have been with him? Just yell it out. Because he was with God. We know the verse, "Draw near to God and he will draw near to you." If we keep drawing near to God, then we know God will be with us at all times. For us to be with God means more than just giving thanks for food, joining in communal prayers. It means staying close to God, even when everything seems unfair, and also when times are good. No matter what's happening, you are communicating with God, appreciating him and valuing what he is doing in your life. I think in all of his thinking, he actually tried to think through why he was actually put into the pit, why they hated him. And I believe he came to understand that. He probably recognised that the favouritism of his father made it impossible for the brothers, and that made it easier for him to forgive them he could probably have thought back over the time when he actually insensitively talked about his dreams that gave the impression that he was going to rule over them. And he probably thought, well, yeah, that probably wouldn't have been received very well, because now he's older and more mature and he can actually see the impact that he's had on his brothers. And I think that has humbled Joseph as well. So he knows now, though, his life was not about him, but about God and what God wanted to do with him. And it is with us. Whatever's going on with us, we shouldn't just think it's all about what we want and what's happening in our lives. It's about what God might be wanting to do with us in our situation. Last week, Stephen reminded me after I'd said that suffering humbles us. And he reminded me that suffering doesn't always humble us. But Joseph had the character to listen to what God could show him. And I think he was genuinely humbled through his time in prison. And so I think he accepted that he was there, not even for him, but because God wanted to do something for others through him. It's always easy for us to accept suffering if we know we're going to benefit from it. But it's a lot harder when we know we're not the ones it's all about. We're actually there for the good of someone else. But when we are in that attitude, it's so much easier for us to forgive. And we need the... Sam, can you pass the microphone back to Sebastian, please?
Yeah. Thanks, David. Just with what you're saying there and with this beautiful picture of this reunion here in this chapter, it really reminds me so much of Christ, and especially that prophecy we have of when Christ returns to the Jews and shows them his hands and his feet and his side, proves that it is him. And they realise, as the brothers have done over these couple of chapters, well, oh, this is what we did, and it's all because of what we've done. And really we see here the way that Joseph is handling it just is so much the character of Christ, isn't it, where he's like, you know, I'm not holding it against you, right? It's good that you understand what you've done, you understand the impact of that, but he's like, it's, you know, it was God that directed me, and we know that it was God that gave his son to be sacrificed. And so it's these things that Joseph is here saying to his brothers is just, in my mind, it's the same things that Christ is going to say to his brethren when he finally returns to the Jews, and they're so sorry for what has happened, what they've done, and it's all, you know, for everyone's benefit, for their benefit, for our benefit, that Christ has gone through all this, and he'll forgive them. And then, as we see in this chapter, he's like, oh, so bring, you know, the rest of your family, come here, there's, you know, I'm going to look after you here in this kingdom. And that's exactly what Christ is going to do. He's going to bring all the rest of the Jews and everyone to be part of that kingdom when he finally does return.
Perfect comparison. Thank you. That's really worthwhile. It's such a similarity. So a little question while the microphone's up and around, along with its holder. So, did the brothers feel forgiven? Who was that? Sorry. Oh, that was Ted, I think.
Ted said no.
He just said no. We don't need a microphone for that. No, they didn't. All right, Ted, you better give us your justification for that perspective.
Well, it revolves around, and you're going to get to it, probably chapter 50. After that Jacob died, they thought, uh-oh, all hell's going to break loose here and we're going to cop it. And they end up writing a letter to him. And Joseph, when he heard the letter, he cried. He broke down in tears because they didn't feel forgiven and they didn't understand Joseph, who God had transformed.
That's exactly where I'm going to.
I think also potentially, David, they didn't accept the forgiveness because they hadn't forgiven themselves yet for what they did, so they weren't open to it.
talk some more about some of that. I think there was a third one there.
It's just really wonderful to actually follow the story of Joseph's kind of descent, ascent, and everything, and the adventure that he's had all the way through, because it really teaches us so much about human nature, the lives that we all live. You know, it doesn't matter whether this story is like 3,000 years ago. This is so, in a sense, current. And I think that's when we read it together and we have the opportunity to exchange thoughts about that. It becomes apparent that, you know, this could be us here. You know, if we were in this situation, how would we respond? How would we react? And it brings me to think that God has set all of this in motion. You know, everything that happens to us in our life happens for a reason, whether it be good, whether it be bad. It's our response to that that really matters. And the challenge that we have is how we respond before our God. And I think if we are mindful of that, then we have an opportunity to be humble, to maybe respond correctly. But we find ourselves often in the situation that our human nature overtakes us and acts before we even think.
It's a sad fact, I can say from experience, that there are amongst us, not I don't mean this room, but amongst the brotherhood, people who don't believe they're forgiven. That's been said to me, they don't believe they're forgiven. And I think that raises an enormous issue for them, but for all of us to really come to grips with the fact forgiveness is absolute forever.
Just a quick point. It reminded me, David, of the, I think it's the parable of the talents, isn't it, where guy that buried his talent said, "I knew you to be a hard man." And so they were still thinking that David was going to bear a grudge and hadn't quite got to that final step of the journey where they realised that he had forgiven them and that they were forgiven. And he was a soft man, not a hard man.
I think we probably should shut off the microphone now. Thanks, Sam. Because I want to spend what time we have left to really think about some of these things and to take some of those points a little bit further. It is really a problem. You know, one of the obvious reasons why we sometimes struggle with accepting forgiveness is when we're guilty, we know we're guilty. We don't deserve to be forgiven. And so to have God or anyone else forgive us when we know we don't deserve it is often very difficult. Our nature is built in with the concept of you get what you deserve. And most of human society works on that basis. And so when you're offered something more than that, it's something that's not always that easy to accept. And Ted's point there about Joseph crying, I think, is a very significant one. He knew then that they hadn't really accepted his forgiveness. They didn't believe in his forgiveness. Imagine how God feels when we don't believe in his forgiveness. That is a very serious thing to say to God, that we can't believe his forgiveness or doubt it. But Joseph didn't get angry. He reassured them of his love and forgiveness. Love always forgives. He didn't want them to be afraid of him. He wanted to have a free, open relationship with nothing from the past getting in the way of it. Because when we don't believe in forgiveness, it actually hinders our relationships with the person. And so it's really, really crucial. And we ought to look at the key words in chapter 50, verses 19 to 21. Even though I've read them before, we had them read earlier, I'm going to read them again. Joseph said to them, "Do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear. I will provide for you and your little ones." and he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. It's like he had to say it all over again. It's not that Joseph is ignoring the wrong. He specifically said, "You meant evil against me." He's not suggesting a cover-up. He's not pretending that it didn't matter, because he's lived through so much. But he has simply chosen not to let it affect him. He's not going to dwell on it for the rest of his life, and he will not let it stand in the way of his relationship with his brothers. That's what it means to forgive. It doesn't remove it. It just stops it making a difference. And we accept them as though they had never wronged us. And his point was, am I in the place of God? He's saying that, I believe, because only God has the right to punish people. When we refuse to forgive others, we are basically saying that we have more right to hold on to our anger than God does. We are more hurt than God, which is sheer pride and makes us obviously unaware of the depth of our sins. The only reason we could ever be like that is if we don't realise just how our sins go up to God so frequently and impact or stand in the way of us responding properly to him. Another key point that Joseph said is that God is using everything for good. And therefore, Joseph could accept anything. It didn't have to benefit him. He was happy for it to benefit others, including his family and many people throughout that realm. He kept many, many people alive. In Matthew 6, verse 14, familiar words, it says, "If you forgive men their trespasses, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive men their trespasses, neither will your Father forgive yours." A lot of people struggle with that. But I believe it's saying that if we cannot show forgiveness to others, and I mean for anything and everything, it means that we actually don't believe in the power of forgiveness. If we can't show forgiveness, we don't believe in the power to forgive. And if we don't believe in the power to forgive, then God can't forgive us because we don't believe in that power. Because we are saying essentially, then God can't forgive us. I believe that the most valuable picture we're ever given of God is that he is our Father. And what's our relationship to him? Children. What kind of children? What's the age are we? Are we 60-year-olds? Are we
infants?
The word I tend to use is toddlers. We are God's toddlers. What do we expect of our toddlers?
Mistakes.
We learn by doing things wrong over and over again. Lots of your parents, do you love your kids less when they make mistakes? No. Often it makes you love them more because you feel that they need it to genuinely care enough to not want to make those mistakes. If we see ourselves as God's toddlers, the one who wants to provide everything that we need, he is happy and eager to forgive us and forget those sins. He doesn't count them against us. They're gone. He hurls them into the depth of the sea, it says. So he knows we're going to mess up. If God can forgive our great sins, then we should forgive others' sins because they're minor in comparison. I believe that forgiveness is only possible when we realise the enormity of how we have grieved God by our sins. And I think that's part of what Joseph learnt. His time of suffering allowed him to think back over his early years and recognise his deficiencies. But he accepted God's forgiveness. So a key question for us to ask ourselves if we struggle with offering forgiveness is, have we always treated others as we should? Because if we can't answer yes to that, and we have no reason to expect that everyone should always have treated us as they should. Until we recognise that we are no better than others, anybody else, we will struggle to forgive people. Other people need our forgiveness just as much as we need theirs. So, a few quick things to finish off. Forgiveness means no desire for revenge or payback. Forgiveness ends feelings of bitterness and anger. And believing in God's forgiveness enables us to forgive. So I urge you, if you have a problem with forgiveness, ask God to help you with that. So, summing up Joseph's life, Joseph believed in God's eternal plan for his people, and he tried to instill that into his people that he left behind as he was dying. He got them to promise that they would take his bones back to the promised land. He was trying to instill hope into the people, and it worked because they did take his bones back and kept the promise. Joseph was honoured by being embalmed by the people of Egypt. And we look back on Joseph's life and we know that he was a powerful man, but he used his power for good for others and never to hurt them. He was a man of suffering who allowed it to train him for service to God. He was a man of integrity who always sought to do what is right. He was a man of forgiveness like Christ, perhaps the example second only to Christ. And above all things, he was a man of faith who never gave up hope despite the enormous amount of suffering that he faced. His attitude was, "But God."